I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. DNA testing is a resource used in criminal justice. With it, guilt or innocence can be determined more decisively, but there's a catch. It doesn't check closed cases. Today, we look at a Kansas bill that may change all that. We'll hear how it looks to address what happens when DNA evidence collected in a current case returns a hit on a closed case. Kansas may be the nation's first state to investigate DNA hits on cases already solved. Then, China's recent refusal to stop taking American plastics wasn't good news for recycling in this country. Good news for the Kansas City area, though. Your plastic and glass and paper are getting recycled. The question is, for how long? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In theory, DNA testing is supposed to open a new world of opportunities for those wrongly accused. With DNA, the thinking goes the actual guilt or innocence of anyone accused of a serious crime can be determined with scientific veracity. But here's a wrinkle I bet you didn't know about. When law enforcement runs DNA through its databases, one result that's not investigated is a hit on closed cases where someone has already been charged and convicted. A bill now working its way through the Kansas legislature aims to make the state the nation's first to start checking DNA even in closed cases. The bill has cleared the Senate. It's now in the state House of Representatives. With us to talk about it are State Senator David Haley, who's the sponsor of this bill. He's a Kansas City, Kansas Democrat. Senator, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Always my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Tricia Bushnell is executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project. Tricia, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Eddie Lowry was once stationed at Fort Riley and joins us this morning via Skype from California. He was exonerated by DNA testing after serving 9 years of a sentence for rape, aggravated burglary, and aggravated battery. Eddie, it's nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Senator Haley, you're like me. I gather you thought law enforcement already checked the DNA of closed cases just to cover all its bases. How surprised were you to find out that that's not happening?
I was extremely surprised.
Yeah, me too.
One would think that, you know, there's no utility served and there's no social utility served by having the wrong person actually incarcerated. And if there is additional evidence that becomes exculpatory, even after someone is being convicted of a particular crime, one would think that that would be applied. But CODIS, or the National DNA database, just hasn't been doing that. And so I was very surprised, and I appreciate Tricia Bushnell and the Midwest Innocence Project and Alvin Sykes with the Emmett Till Justice Campaign bringing it to my attention and bringing what has become this legislation.
So, Senator, your bill would do what?
Very simply, it would put a task force together, and the task force would be reporting later next year in 2020. We're actually trying to get it moved back. That task force would be composed of various stakeholders who would analyze what DNA or how the DNA should be applied to particular cases. When they make that report next year, then we would begin right after that to utilize the task force recommendation.
And just quickly, I mentioned the bill is through the state Senate. It's now in the House. Its chances of passage, do you have a read on it?
I hate to handicap the Kansas legislature,
yes,
because so
smart,
often
smart. Yeah.
We labor under the assumptions that don't come together. But it's in what's called a conference committee report. It's a part of a conference committee report, which is House Bill 2290. We go back on the 1st of May. We're in recess now. Conference committee reports will be taken up then, and I feel very confident that conference committee report on House Bill 2290, which contains what was Senate Bill 102 on the DNA applied to close cases, will indeed be passed.
You know, Tricia, what's different about this legislation if it goes into effect, and what's already in place today?
Well, at this point in time, we don't know what's in place. And that's what's really important about this legislation, is it's saying, let's take a look at what's happening. And maybe the task force could, in theory, say everything's going swimmingly, and we can know that. But what the issue is when someone's convicted and there was DNA evidence that either didn't match them or excluded them, right? But they get convicted based on an ID or something else, that in theory, that evidence should be continually running through the database. And so when there is a hit now to that evidence, because somebody else now, years later, gets arrested, convicted, and now their DNA is also in the database, so now there's a match to who that person was, who gets notified? That's the question. Because normally, the way that the notification system works is it goes to the law enforcement agency. And that agency is usually working with the prosecutor, right? And if there was a match to someone else, that prosecutor would have to, under what's called Brady, having to give over all the exculpatory evidence, would have to give that to the defense. Mm-hmm. But when someone's already convicted, what does law enforcement do with it when they see that there's a hit in a case where someone's already convicted? We don't even know. Does it even get to the prosecutor? Does it get to anyone? We just don't know.
Why would it be in the realm of possibility that a hit would occur on a closed case and law enforcement would walk away from that? That seems incredible to me.
Well, I think
if in fact it's happening, maybe it's not.
Part of it is, I think there's a training issue, right? Or maybe it's going into a box and they don't know, or maybe they say that person's already been convicted and they think this was one of many pieces of evidence, for example, and this one gets a hit to somebody else, but they were convicted on other DNA evidence. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why somebody would get this hit and just not know what to do with it, especially if there's no protocol in place. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is we need to have this overt conversation and look at it and make those protocols. You know, we know from cases, there's a case of Michael Mercer, who was exonerated in New York. We know from his case, for example, he was convicted based on an ID. And there was a.
When you say an ID, you mean what?
A witness looking at him in court and saying he's the one who did it.
Just an eyewitness. Yeah. He looks like the guy who did this.
Yeah, the identification. There was a rape kit collected in that case. It was a sexual assault. That case went and sat in the backlog of the rape kit backlogs you hear, right? So over a decade later, they test it. And once that's tested, it matched to someone else in the database, right, who had gone on to commit other crimes. And that's part of what's so important about this is it's really a public safety issue. It's really, you know, we know of the 350 DNA exonerations, we've identified the real perpetrator in about 180 of those cases who went on to commit over 130 other crimes, many of which are rapes and homicides, right? So we want to know we're getting the right folks and keeping people safe.
But still, just to clarify, Kansas would be the first state in the country to get this. That also seems highly improbable to me that so many states have not even considered the idea of testing closed cases with DNA evidence.
Well, they're certainly testing cold cases, which I think is what people think about.
Cold
right?
cases.
But we're talking
that's
about
different.
Closed. That's right.
Closed cases where people have already been sentenced and convicted and the state has walked away from the case.
And I think part of that is, though, when you look at the resources, every part of the criminal justice system is under-resourced, right? That also includes law enforcement. That also includes prosecutors. So if they've already got a conviction, why would they be putting in additional effort unless usually the defense is coming to them and saying you did it incorrectly, right? Or something went wrong is usually what we're saying. So that's why this task force would be so important to say, let's just make sure we're doing it correctly, that there's this safety valve there, because that's the reality. It's a human system, and we have to have a safety mechanism to correct when we mess up. And this is really looking at it to allow for that.
Well, Eddie Lowery, again, joining us via Skype from California this morning. You are a victim of this system. I mean, what do you make of the fact that these closed cases aren't being checked?
Well, I think they should look at these cases, and this law should be passed, because in my case, it took 27 years, I think, to find the real perpetrator. So he ran free for 27 years after raping a woman that they convicted me of raping. So for me, it was closure in my case, along with the DNA that exonerated me. And I just think it's a shame that, you know, it's not being followed up in more states to exonerate more men and women.
Eddie, if you would, just briefly, and I don't mean to shortchange all the years you spent in prison, but just briefly tell us what happened to you.
I was involved in a car accident.
What year was this?
This was 1981. Mm-hmm. So, but I was convicted in 1982, so I spent a year in a county jail. I went through two jury trials. The second jury trial, they convicted me. So I spent... I count it as 10 years in prison because I was convicted. I was arrested in 1981 and released in 1991. And I made parole. I wasn't exonerated. So I fought my case for another 11 years, registering as a sex offender or either on parole for the next 11 years. And I was finally exonerated in 2003. Then we filed. Then in 2009, a cold hit was found on the real perpetrator, and he was sentenced in 2010 to 10 to 20 years for the crime they sentenced me 11 to life for.
What's that like? What was that like for you serving that much time for a crime you hadn't committed?
Well, there's a lot of factors that go into that. First of all, you know, you're just wondering why this happens to you. Why didn't the system protect you when you're in the interrogation room telling them you're innocent, and how the system, you know, failed me in that case and other exonerees. And then you're running through prison, and, you know, it was a rape case. So now I'm trying to protect my identity as a sex offender, so I don't get beat up in there and you know, the horrible things that happened to sex offenders in there. After making it through that, then I'm registering as a sex offender after I get out. So it was just a real traumatic, horrible experience for me, and I was very happy that I was able to prove my innocence. And later, a cold hit on the real perpetrator was found.
Yeah, okay. And so you spent this time in prison, and you were innocent, and the mental struggle for you was what?
Staying alive in prison, because I'd never been in prison before. I'd never had this kind of experience. I didn't know what to expect. Knowing that I'm a sex offender in prison was a tremendous stress on my life. And just trying to survive and figure a way out, because I was going to the parole board and telling them I didn't commit this crime, and they were passing me every time I went to the parole board until finally I accepted all the courses that they wanted me to take in order to make parole. So when I completed all that, that's when I made parole. But it was just a struggle being in prison and, you know, coming from a life that, you know, I wasn't a criminal. I didn't commit, you know, crimes when I was young. I didn't know what to expect. So it was just a struggle.
Eddie,
yeah.
If I understand your situation correctly, you were a victim of a very long interrogation where you were not given food or water. It dragged on for hour after hour after hour. You finally confessed, thinking you would battle this whole thing in court. You confess naively now, not really understanding how the system works, and the whole thing backfired on you.
Well, yeah, but, you know, during the confession part, I know I wasn't looking at it as I was giving them a confession. I was under interrogation for 2 days. I asked for a lawyer. They refused to give me a lawyer. I was in the Army. I asked to call my company commander. They refused to let me call my company commander. I had I even took a polygraph test for them to prove my innocence. They told me that I failed it. And so after all this time, I didn't know how to get out of this situation. I had my arms crossed on the table, my forehead's on my arms. I'm crying, and I didn't know what to do. So I just repeated back information that I learned during the interrogation. And then at the end of the interrogation, they call it a confession, basically. And they said in court that I calmly and collectively gave them intimate details that only the perpetrator knew, which if my interrogation had been videotaped, they would have known that was a lie too.
Senator Haley, you know, if this law is passed, I'm wondering, will law enforcement authorities just check against Kansas closed cases, or will there be a national database involved somehow?
Well, certainly it's our hope that it will begin in Kansas. I mean, just hearing him recount what he went through, certainly
it
we
just
would
makes
not,
you crazy.
We would absolutely. If you think about the 4% or so who are wrongfully convicted, being any one of those, as the gentleman that's on with us now, would just be a nightmare. So obviously we would not, or we would hope that it wouldn't stop at the state line, that once this is enacted and actually our task force does come back with recommendations, it's a national database, DNA database, CODIS, that we're relying on. So why wouldn't it be applied? There has been some discussion as to what the cost would be to apply to every
case. I was just going to ask my next question. What is the cost of this new system?
I don't know. That's probably a better question for Tricia Bushnell with Midwest Innocence. But I would hope entities, you know, the beauty about this really, Steve, is across the board, Smart Justice wants to ensure that society is safe and that there's no social utility that's served by having the wrongfully convicted serve the time when you still have at large the real criminal. And mm-hmm. that's been the concern. So you have the diaspora of political thought on this, all the way from the Koch Foundation on one side to Soros on the other,
right.
and everywhere in between for smart justice
people
to be
applied.
People
are looking at criminal justice in a new way now.
So we're hoping some entities will pick up the nominal cost that it would be to take the matrix of DNA and to apply it to each closed case, wherever it would be. And I don't think it's so expensive, but I'm not the expert
Trisha,
on that.
Trisha, is it nominal?
It should be for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, the number of wrongful convictions is already low, right? We're looking at 4%, which is a lot if you're the person who's wrongfully convicted, but it means that the system generally gets it right. And then what we're looking at is a smaller section of that where they've already did DNA in the case. That DNA is already being run in the system. We're just asking what happens when it gets a hit to another offender in the database.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a creation of new testing. It's not going back and opening new evidence. It's saying when this hit happens, who gets notified?
Yeah. Explain to us the different ways that DNA is tested, Trish, and why it can lead to a false positive.
So it depends on which, you know, era of DNA testing you're looking at. But if back in the early 90s when DNA came about, we used something called RFLP. And that type of DNA testing only looks at certain, not very many places on the DNA strand. And what it was able to say is this person could have done it or this person could not have done it, but it wasn't sensitive enough to say this must be the only person who could have done it in the world. Since then, you know, we've come to a different kind of testing that we call STR testing, and we created a way to amplify the sample. So RFLP took a huge amount of DNA, blood, right, or something significant. With this new PCR, we can copy it just like you do basically in a copy machine, and that allows you to use much smaller samples, right, mm-hmm. when you think about touch DNA. But the issue with that is now one of the ways that DNA now leads to wrongful convictions is just like when you copy something on a copy machine, sometimes you get extra dirt in it, right, mm-hmm. and it gets muddier or things drop out. And that also happens when you amplify something that's too small. And so even though when we're using touch DNA, we can sometimes get results that aren't quite as accurate. So DNA has solved numbers, tons of wrongful convictions where we knew it wasn't sensitive or specific enough, and we could become more sensitive to say this wasn't the individual or this must be. But as we become more sensitive, you know, we have contamination, we have other issues dropping in, so we really have to look at how those processes are being used going forward.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about legislation in the Kansas State Senate. It's now in the House that would examine DNA evidence and apply that evidence to close cases in an attempt to release folks who have been wrongly accused and convicted here. Trisha, when someone is exonerated and police catch the actual perpetrators, what have we learned about how many more crimes the actual perpetrators have committed during the years the wrong person was in prison?
Well, we know that in DNA cases, there's been significant when we've been able to identify that real individual. They have often gone on to commit other crimes. So as I was mentioning, there's about 350 DNA exonerations. And over half of those, we've identified the real perpetrators, and they've gone on to commit about 130 additional crimes, significant crimes, major crimes. One of the other interesting questions is what happens to whether or not they get convicted for the crime somebody was exonerated for. And the reality is they often don't get convicted of that.
Hmm.
There's been a significant writing. I think Laura Bazelon's been doing a lot of writing about that, about why that is.
But, why is it?
Quite frankly, to do that would require the system to acknowledge the mistake in many ways.
And there's some hesitancy to do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
David, you mentioned the figure 4% of folks in prisons now wrongly convicted. Where does that number come from?
That's an estimate actually on a national basis. But in Kansas, we have just over 10,000 currently convicted or currently serving time.
Yeah.
About 10,005, you know, men and women. And if it's 4%, if it's 2%, you know, whatever that number is, we're talking hundreds of people that shouldn't be serving that time. And again, hundreds of true perpetrators that are at large if they haven't been convicted on some other crime. And to have that covered is something that to try to have something applied or to bring yet another tool to make sure that those that shouldn't be serving are exonerated and those that should be are then incarcerated is something I think that serves social utility across the board.
Eddie, we have a question on Twitter from Rachel, and she asks, are you able to be compensated in any way when you have been wrongly convicted as you were in Kansas? What about that?
Yeah, I was compensated filed a civil lawsuit. At the time, Kansas didn't have compensation law, but we went through a civil lawsuit and was able to get compensated through the insurance companies that covered the entities that were involved in this.
I mean, what happened to your life while you were in prison? What did you miss out on?
Oh, you want me to start crying or what?
Well, yeah.
No. I had a 3-year-old daughter at the time. I missed out on her growing up, the bonding there. My parents, you know, my mom passed away. I got to see her one time after I got out. My dad passed away before I was exonerated. It kind of destroyed my whole, you know, my relationship with my family a lot, because I was in Kansas, they're in California, so it was a big separation there through all this time, and it was very hard to keep a relationship with them. And when I got out and I finally got to go home and see everybody, that's one of the biggest things that struck me the most, was how much they aged away from me while I was in prison, and all that time I missed being with them.
You know, at first you were dishonorably discharged from the Army. How difficult was that to get that reversed for you?
It took after I was exonerated, or after my compensation, I took the initiative myself and filed the paperwork to get that overturned. I sent the Army, the board, my exoneration papers and everything I could find, and it didn't take that long. They gave me an honorable discharge within the year after I filed.
I'm just curious, did you ever give up hope that you'd be able to prove your innocence?
No, that's one thing that I never did give up hope. There were times that I struggled with the hope, that wondering if this is ever going to, if I'm ever going to prove my innocence. But I just kept pushing forward, and, and I knew there would be a light at the end of the tunnel. And, whether you want to say that's spiritual or whatever, I just had that hope in me that, someday that I would prove my innocence.
Senator Haley, how tough a sell was this issue in the legislature? Because, as you know far better than I, this is a pretty conservative group when it comes to law enforcement kinds of issues.
Actually, Steve, this actually passed on a consent calendar, which means
there
was
no. I saw that. That surprised me too.
Yeah, there was only one no, and that was someone who didn't want to create a new bureaucracy of a task force. Mm-hmm. No more government task force, but in concept, everyone in the Kansas Senate that voted supported it. And if I could say one quick thing, we're chipping away at inaccuracies, like Eddie is his name. Mm-hmm. As we in Kansas, we now have the compensation wrong. Last year,
right,
that was passed for those that are wrongfully incarcerated, thanks to the Innocence Project and Alvin Sykes with the Emmett Till Project. We also now have videotaping for interrogations, all felony interrogations. These are new laws that we have, and also eyewitness ID benchmarks. All of these that I have championed, but all of them were the ideas that came to me through the Innocence Project and the Midwest Innocence Project and Trisha Bushnell and others, and again, Alvin Sykes with the Emmett Till Justice Campaign.
Well, the bill here is House Bill 2290. We'll be watching its progress closely here. I want to thank State Senator David Haley again, a Kansas City, Kansas Democrat. Senator, always appreciate your time.
Thank you, Steve. Always enjoy.
Trisha Bushnell is Executive Director of the Midwest Innocence Project. Trisha, thank you.
Thank you.
Eddie Lowry, thank you for taking some time with us this morning via Skype from California. We wish you all the best, Eddie.
All right. Thank you very much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about recycling and if there's a future to it in this area or not. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, one of the most respected voices in political journalism, Mara Liasson, described how she found her way to NPR. You can hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Ahead this week on Up to Date, a convention in the 70s designed to bring America's women together provoked a bitter debate over abortion, gay rights, and other issues. The results of the National Women's Conference later this week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the state of recycling around the country isn't very good right now. These days, many cities have shuttered their recycling programs. Instead, they're sending all the plastic and paper that was getting recycled to the dump. They're even burning it. One big problem: China won't take our plastics anymore. The good news, right now, all this is not happening in the Kansas City area. Our leftover products that you put in your bins are, in fact, getting recycled. The not-so-good news comes in the form of a question. How long will that recycling last? With us to talk about the state of recycling, Matt Riggs is the outreach coordinator for the Mid-America Regional Council's Solid Waste Management District. Matt, nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Dr. Syed Hassan is a professor emeritus at UMKC who taught courses in waste management and authored a college textbook on hazardous waste management. Dr. Hassan, nice to have you. Welcome.
My pleasure. Good to be here. Thank you.
Tom Kaufman is a municipal representative for WCA Waste. Tom, good morning to you.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
You know, Matt, from the Mid-America Regional Council, why are so many cities shutting down their recycling programs? What's going on out there?
Well, the biggest cause behind it all is China basically has turned off the tap. Mm-hmm. They don't want our scrap plastic and paper.
Why? They were a good customer for a long time.
We were sending them way too much trash. What we have been sending them for many years has been highly contaminated.
Meaning that the recycling, the plastics were regular trash was mixed in with it.
Right. Lots of trash. So very high percentage of trash was getting there, and they got to the point where like we don't want that anymore. So mm-hmm. they're basically saying, we don't want your stuff.
So what's happening now? If China's shut the tap, where's mm-hmm. the stuff going?
Well, as you said, there are places, especially on the coasts, like the West Coast, where they're warehousing a lot of the recycling. Some cases they're having to landfill it. In some cases they're burning it and that kind of stuff. But luckily right here in the metro area, we're still able to move our stuff and have it be recycled. So,
Dr. Hassan, I'm just wondering what's happening on the West Coast. Could that happen here in Kansas City where suddenly the curbside recycling program shut down?
I don't think it would happen here. As you just heard, the capacity is pretty much under control here, the amount of waste that is generated, and we are handling it very well. But I do want to add another element to what was said just now about China. It's true that a lot of the waste that was going from here was contaminated, but one other reason why China is stopping it is that they are trying to improve their own recycling. And they say that by 2020, they are going to have a large percentage of their trash getting recycled in their own country itself. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there has been an environmental problem in recycling the waste material into useful products. And China has got some serious issues with the environmental air quality, and we hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. So it is a kind of combination of several factors that really has led China to stop getting the waste. They have not stopped all the waste, by the way. What they have stopped is, they say, unsorted plastic, they say mixed papers, and textiles. These are the three main items.
Okay.
Other waste are still going, metals and all are going there for recycling.
Tom Kaufman, again, with WCA Waste. I'm still a little confused. If China has turned off the tap, at least for a lot of recycling products, what's happening then with the stuff that's gathered here in Kansas City, and why haven't we been affected?
Well, when China closed the door, there wasn't a domestic infrastructure. The mills couldn't absorb everything that was being generated and being moved. So there was a lot of scrambling going along and a lot of sorting out. Now, we're fortunate here because WCA, and I think other haulers and processors too, have good material, they're good at sorting, and that's important, and they have good relationships with companies. So you can always move the material. But you never know. I mean, you can't think that's going to happen forever.
So you're saying the waste, that the recycling product that we're shipping out of Kansas City has been better sorted, perhaps, than in other parts of the country, and China's still accepting it, Tom? Do I have that right?
No. 70% of what we move goes to domestic markets.
Okay.
So 30% goes overseas. But those 70%, they're demanding clean material, too, because they're such a glut that they can afford to be choosy.
Yeah. Professor, you say something very interesting point blank, and you say that recycling isn't about the environment, it's about money. Explain that to me.
Recycling is a capital-intensive process, and what they try to gain out of the process is any other product that will bring them revenue. And one of the things that is very attractive and has become attractive these days because of the glut and the limitation on the import, export and all that is that what we call WTE, waste to energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big thing now. Connecticut, for example, so about 70% of the solid waste that is generated in the state of Connecticut is used for generating electricity.
Huh.
And then there are about 21 states currently who are doing that, and this is going to improve. And I think
we're not doing that here in Kansas or Missouri, though.
No, I was talking to you just now. No, we are not doing that. And shutting the door, as we mentioned, China, it is a great opportunity for us to think about turning our waste into energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the states that are not doing that, they should really very seriously consider doing it, because that's a very good option.
Matt, why is China the biggest buyer of recycled goods? What is it about that market that's been the place that so much of this goes?
Well, they're, you know, a huge economy. I mean, they rival the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. And so for the last 30, 40 years, they started out needing our material because it was less developed 30 or 40 years ago. And so they're like, yeah, give us all you got.
They can recycle it and reuse it.
Right. So we got comfortable sending them all of our stuff over there with the high percentage of trash. We thought everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few years ago, they came up with the green fence, which should have been a good warning shot over the bow that said, you know.
What's the green fence?
It basically said that, you know, we're, you know, we got our eye on this. We don't want, you know, we're starting to clamp down. We don't want as much trash. We're going to, you know, reduce the percentage of contamination you can have in here. And so we started paying attention a little bit, but not enough. And so now it's, you know, we're facing the consequences. But it was a very large economy that wanted our stuff, and now they don't want it. So,
you know, Tom, one of the big issues here, if I understand right, you're talking about the recycling being contaminated with everyday trash. If that's the case, when I put my recycling out every Tuesday morning, why don't I separate my recycling into glass, into plastics, into paper? That would help reduce the amount of waste that gets infused in there.
Well, this market and most markets in the country moved to single stream a long time ago.
Single stream meaning everything's dumped in the same bin.
Yeah, and then just take it off to your materials recovery facility. You guys sort it out. Now we're seeing across the country a move towards a dual stream, like on the first and third weeks, we'd pick up your fiber products, paper and stuff. And on the second, fourth, we'd get your containers, metals and plastics. And that has that leads to a cleaner stream.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be catching some momentum across the country.
Is that going to come here at some point?
It's not out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, you know, we see 22 to 25% of everything that comes into our facility every single day is just trash.
22 to 25%?
I was talking to somebody at our MRF yesterday, and she said in the space of 20 minutes, she saw some little pad that you have puppies pee on, a soiled baby diaper, and a big slab of bacon.
In the recycling?
Yeah, coming across the machinery.
But in fairness, I mean, nothing justifies that, but I think a lot of people still are confused out there as to what types of materials can, in fact, be recycled.
I'm inclined to be generous that way, too.
Well, it's true. But I think it's true. As a consumer, I get some of that. I'm confused sometimes.
Yeah. No, it's public education on what's available and what's acceptable is going to just be a constant ongoing thing if these programs are going to survive.
What do we have to do, Professor, to improve the public awareness of what can be recycled versus what can't be?
As was said just now, I think public education is so important. We cannot stop doing that. I know that this process of educating the public and putting all the magnets on the fridge and all that has been going on for 20, 25 years at least. Mark has done an excellent job. But still, it has not sunk in the thinking of common person. Mm-hmm. That when they are ready to take the trash out, they put it separately or make sure that recyclables are not put in the same container or not mixed up.
I bet, Matt, a lot of people are inclined. They want to recycle, so they end up erring on the side of recycling things they shouldn't be just because they'd rather see the stuff get recycled than put in the trash.
Right.
Put the landfill.
Right. It's called wishful recycling.
Is that what it is? There's a name for it, eh?
It's wishful recycling.
Yeah.
Where people think, you know, this whatever it is I have, I really don't want to see it go in the trash. I'll throw it in the recycling bin even though I'm not sure, because surely somebody along the way will recycle it.
Yeah.
But really all they're doing is moving their trash over to Tom's facility where he has to throw it away and pay for that.
Why isn't the stuff marked more clearly so that when I unpack a box from Amazon or something, I know whether the plastic stuff that's wrapping, the bubble wrap that's wrapped around whatever I just bought, can in fact be recycled or not?
Well, the problem is there's a lot of packages you get will say this is recyclable, or if it's plastic, it'll have one of the resin codes on it, which is the 1 through 7s, or it'll have some recycling instructions on it. But those are general. So those somewhere, theoretically, yes, you can recycle, for instance, maybe a styrofoam takeout box or a used motor oil container, because they have the symbols on them.
Right.
But you can't recycle those here in the metro area because there's no regional market for those types of materials, for instance.
So I empty out a Pennzoil oil container into my car, I can't recycle that.
Right, right. See, even though it has a recycling symbol on it. Yeah, so that's...
I would have recycled it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why we're, you know, the China thing is a problem, and there are other issues going on, but what we're really focused on is the solution, because, you know, the average listener out there, you know, can't go over and do an international trade war with China. But what they can do is they can recycle better. And so we have our flyer called the Recycle More, Recycle Better flyer on our website, recyclespot.org. And that's our attempt to really give people a one-stop spot for the whole metro area. So we work with all the area material recovery facilities, including Tom's, to say, like, what materials do you want? What don't you want? And then we put it all in a flyer, yes, no list. So really that's all the average listener can do is just recycle better. Put what goes in the bin, and what shouldn't go in the bin, not in the bin, and the stuff that should go, prepare it properly.
Well, I'm just betting here that your comments are going to spark some questions among our listeners as to what should be recycled and what shouldn't be. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. One question already from Eric, who asked, why are we not charging a user fee for any item that has plastic in it? Packaging, parts, bags, etc. 5 cents an item will go a long way towards improving the system. We do this now for tires. It's $5 a tire for disposal, Tom. Why not charge a fee for plastic?
Because it's politically impossible.
Is it?
I mean, the history of bottle bills in the country, this doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, why didn't they work?
He's right about that. It's a political issue, but I think times have changed. What didn't work 20 years ago may not be true now. And if we again do the right job of educating the public and telling them, hey, this is what is important, and the generation is more conscious and aware about environmental issues than the previous generation. So I think its timing is right to tell them about it. Tax, yes, it is a difficult issue, but I am in favor of putting a little tax on plastics. If you use plastic, maybe one penny extra.
Yeah. You think that might make a difference?
Yes, it would, definitely.
Yeah.
It has happened in other countries. They've done that, and it is happening.
Tom Kaufman, again, with WCA Waste. Let's talk a little more about what happens with the stuff that you guys take in. How many tons of recycling a month do you guys deal with? Do you have any sense off the top of your head?
We move about 250 tons a day through our processor.
250 tons a day.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens at the processor?
It gets tipped off on the floor. It gets dumped into the sorting system, and it separates by metals, various kinds of metals, various kinds of plastics. Paper gets separated.
This is all automated now.
Almost all. There's people on the front end who pick off the trash primarily. You know, a baby pool will come by and they throw that away.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it's all mostly mechanical separation, and then it's separated, processed a little bit more, and then bundled up, baled up, and shipped out.
Why is a baby pool tossed out? I would think that'd be a great thing to recycle.
It's not.
Why?
Because the resins are wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just doesn't work.
Just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's a container-intensive system for plastics.
Mm-hmm. Well, why aren't more recovery centers now ensuring that we're not shipping trash overseas? Why hasn't that been checked more closely?
It was sort of a different environment at the time. You could get away with stuff easier.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to, because processing has some costs. And some of what we were talking about earlier, I don't think people are cognizant of the real cost of recycling, you know, for between the collection and processing. So it's just more expensive to process it to a finer degree of less contamination.
But cities pay for it. Don't I pay for recycling and part of my trash collection fee?
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
But it doesn't. At one time, you could collect the material and you could process the material and you could market the material and you could make a little bit of money.
Right.
That's not so much the case now.
Hmm.
The material values don't cover the costs on the front end.
Then why are you guys still doing it?
Because we're committed to it.
Why?
Because that's part of our industry. Mm-hmm. Also, there's city contracts, there's county codes that require it, there's homes association contracts. I mean, it's part of the industry.
So to get the trash work, you have to do the recycling work.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it works. And, you know, it's a cyclical industry, so we're just hoping that, you know, we'll stick it out and it'll get better.
You know, when it comes to the Mid-America Regional Council, I'm wondering, Matt, what you think needs to happen in our metro to improve the whole recycling system.
Well, like I said, we have the flyer that we're putting out, so we do all kinds of presentations all the time to schools, neighborhood associations, Earth Day events, etc. Well, we're getting this information out there, but where we could really use help is through haulers, like all the haulers that serve our area, if they could, you know, forward our flyer or something that's comparable to our flyer out to there. So they need to increase education to their customers. And a lot of what people don't realize is that they rely a lot on their cities to provide services, to educate them on ways that they can recycle. And a lot of our cities are still kind of at arm's length with the whole trash and recycling thing. So we could really use all the cities' help.
Why are the cities at arm's length?
Well, in our area, we have cities that handle trash in one of three ways. Either they do it themselves, like the city of Casey Moe. They handle their own trash. They have the equipment and the staff to do it all their own. Or they contract with a hauler. So they contract directly with one hauler or something, and that hauler serves their whole area. Or they're totally hands-off, and it's private subscription. So everybody on a given block pays to have whatever trash and recycling hauler they want, which can mean there can be anywhere from 6 to 12 or more haulers serving a single area. Wow. So the one neighborhood may have several trash days because every hauler picks up on a different day. So that's part of the confusion. People are like, I'm not sure how the trash works. Well, it's different. I mean, we're 9-county area, 119 cities. Every city's a little bit different. But the one thing that all cities and counties could do too is just to help us get the word out, because really the education and outreach is one of the most crucial components of the whole recycling industry, and we really need more help with that because we're only so many people on our staff.
What do you think the future looks like? Oh, as you look at the future, Matt, what's the future of recycling in the metro appear to you to be?
Well, it's did you guys bring the crystal ball? I didn't bring my crystal ball. But it's hard to say. I mean, we'd hope that, in general, we see, like, when a city contracts for services, they get better service for a better price.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something that's a fact. It's not something we're out there actively pushing and promoting, but that's the fact. So if more cities did that, you know, that would probably make an improvement in how the recycling system and trash system operates.
Professor, what do you think the future looks like?
If we have the political will and we come from the top that, well, this has to be done, combined with education, awareness, I think we should be able to improve our recycling rate tremendously. Because a state like Michigan, their rate is higher than any other state.
Mm-hmm.
Nationally, our rate is just around 35%, 34-35%. But I see no reason why it couldn't go to 75 or even 90%.
34% of people who participate?
No, 35% of all the solid waste that is generated is recycled.
Oh, it could be way higher than that, you're saying.
It should be. Yeah, it could be.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Marilyn from Kansas City. Marilyn, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, in order to help with awareness, even seasoned recyclers don't get this right, could there be demonstrations or table setups in grocery stores, hardware stores, libraries, places where people go all the time to actually show what's in and what's out?
How about setting up tables in grocery stores? That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think you probably have more luck at a library than a grocery store. Grocery stores are private entities, and they're like, they set the rules for what they will and won't allow in the grocery store. But there's no reason you couldn't, like, you know, the Mid-Continent Public Library or Casey Library or the library system could have an information table set up at their library. That's certainly, you know, an option.
Monica from Lee Summit. Monica, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, I understand that we cannot recycle styrofoam, but what about plastic takeout containers that we wash? Can we still recycle those or not because they've had a food product?
Tom?
We'd prefer not to see them just because we don't know. I mean, I'm sure she does a great job cleaning out her containers, but not everybody does. So if you open that up, we're going to get contamination.
Mm-hmm. But you want people to wash out the stuff they put in recycling, just generally speaking, right?
Clean and dry. That's kind of that's the rule of thumb when it comes to our material. Clean and dry.
Clean and dry. Okay.
Yeah, because one of the biggest problems we have in the curbside stream is food contamination and any kind of liquid contamination. That can ruin a lot of recyclables that are around it. So.
Okay. Some education, more education is needed here. I want to leave the conversation there. Matt Riggs with the Mid-America Regional Council, Dr. Syed Hassan, Professor Emeritus over at UMKC, Tom Kaufman with WCA Waste. Thank you all for a good conversation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.
Yesterday, I interviewed NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson as part of our ongoing spring membership drive. If you haven't done so already, you can still make a donation at kcur.org or call us at 816-235-5287 to make your pledge. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.